This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. You know the famous saying, April showers bring May flowers. Well, it's May. The flowers are blooming, the trees are starting to green, and the fruit, veggie, and flower gardeners among us are raring to go. Today is Vermont Edition's annual spring gardening show. We are joined, as we always are, by Charlie Nardozzi. He's a gardening consultant, speaker, and TV and radio host. You can hear him on All Things Gardening with Mary Angish on Vermont Public Sunday mornings. Charlie, welcome back to the show.
It's always great to be here, Michaela.
Oh, we are so glad to have you. We already, have so many questions coming in. You are very popular. We would also love to take your calls this hour, too. If you have a gardening question, we have Charlie here to answer it. You can give us a call at 800-639-2211. You can also email us at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. So, Charlie, let's start with the weather here. It is a beautiful day here in Colchester, Vermont, where you and I are right now. The sun is shining. It is warm. But there's rain ahead. What has this spring's weather told you about how the growing season is going to go so far?
Well, so far it looks pretty nice out there. We've had a nice spell where there was some rainy weather, then some drier weather. So things have popped up. The bulbs are looking beautiful. The flowering trees, especially the fruit trees, which I think is because last year we got a frost or a freeze around this time, if you remember. And so a lot of those flowers died and the trees never set fruit. So now they have all this energy and it's like, okay, let's go. So the fruit trees are blooming really beautifully too. So a lot of things are happening kind of on a little earlier than normal schedule, but probably pretty good. I was a little concerned back in March or so when it was really warm. It didn't have a lot of snow. Things were kind of pushing along. And then we got a couple of nice snowstorms. I know many people weren't excited about an April snowstorm. But that slowed everything down again, put some more moisture in the soil. And so now I think we're in pretty good shape. And as long as the weather and the temperatures stay on the cool side, a lot of the things you see flowering are going to stay flowering. Like forsythia, for example. It's been flowering for weeks, it seems.
Oh, it's so beautiful. The yellow bursts all over.
Yeah, very full, just like the fruit trees. A lot of flowers, a lot of fullness to them. And I expect the same is going to be happening with the lilacs and the peonies and a lot of the other plants that are going to be coming in succession here really quickly.
Yeah, when is that lilac smell going to start to fill
the air?
Pretty
soon. I saw some just almost open the other day. So depending on where you are, if you're in a warmer little spot, a little protected microclimate, you might be a week or so earlier than other folks who are maybe up in the mountains. So, yeah, it's happening quickly.
Great. Well, you talked about some of the early spring blooms, and we've received a couple questions about that to our email and on Instagram at Vermont Public. One person on Instagram asks, what should I do if my daffodils are not flowering? Is there anything you can do?
Yes, there is, especially for daffodils and narcissus, which are basically daffodils, you know, the little or big flowered bulbs, because they're not blooming usually for a couple different reasons. One of them is usually not a problem with narcissus and daffodils because the little rodents don't like them. But for tulips, for example, rodents might get in there. Mice and voles go in and eat the bulbs. Daffodils are not on their palate. They don't really like it very much. But what can happen to them is that if you have clay soil especially, they might be planted a little too deep, or they might be setting little bulb offsets around them, and so they don't have as much energy to flower. So what you do is wait a little longer until the foliage starts to yellow. It doesn't have to die all the way back, but just starts to yellow. Dig them up, take a look at cut off the foliage, take a look at the bulbs, and see if there's little bulblets around there. Just kind of knock them all off, just peel them all off, and then reset those bulbs either in the same spot, especially if it's a sunny spot and well-drained soil. That's a good spot, or if it's not a good spot, find a better one, maybe by your mailbox. But you're really looking for a nice, well-drained soil. That's really key. And also sun. It doesn't have to be sun all summer, but sun this time of year before the leaves of the deciduous trees come out.
Bulblets. Is that a technical term?
Bulblets it is, yes.
I love that.
All those little bulblets.
Another question about early bloomers. Somebody on Instagram asks, I have spring bulbs and garlic that I didn't get around to planting in the fall. Can I plant them this spring?
Not really. The spring bulbs are probably not going to do anything. You could try the garlic, but even that it's kind of late already for doing a spring planting of garlic. But if it's a matter of composting them versus trying to put them in the ground, why not? I've seen miracles happen before. You never know what's going to happen in the garden. So if it's a matter of just giving them a try, put them in a protected spot, let them go and see what happens.
Well, we are joined today by gardening expert Charlie Nardozzi. Call in with your gardening questions, or maybe you have a tip to share about a plant you've had good success with, or a way that you prepare your beds this time of year for a good growing season ahead. You can call in at 800-639-2211. All right, one more question for you about early bloomers. How do you care for early blooming, like daffodils and tulips, to set them up for success next year?
So the key thing is to let the foliage ripen or turn yellow, like I was talking about. Yeah, so if you're planting them, if say you have them naturalized in a lawn or in a flower bed somewhere, and once the flowers are gone, the temptation is to not only cut off the dead flower stalk, but all the leaves. You don't want to do that. You want to leave the leaves.
Okay.
Because that's going to feed the bulb for next year. Once they start browning and yellowing, then you can cut them off and clean them up. So that would be the first thing. The other thing to do is to mark where, or try to remember, or take pictures. That's what I do. I take video on my cell phone of our beds this time of year. So then the fall, when I want to plant new bulbs, I'll know where the holes are, where the spots are to plant the new bulbs. And also in the fall, that's when you would want to fertilize them. Mm-hmm. So if they haven't really been looking very robust, haven't really flowered really well, you can try putting some of that bulb booster fertilizer or just some compost down, but do it in the fall because that's when the bulbs are setting their roots and getting ready for next spring's show.
Mm. Help me settle a debate here that I've had with my mother.
Uh-oh, getting between you and your mother. This could be dangerous.
So she does a thing with her daffodils where she folds them over and kind of ties them up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes a little braid out of them. You know.
Yes, she swears by it. Seems like a lot of effort to me.
It is a lot of effort.
Does it work?
Well, it works in the sense that it makes it look a little neater, I think, and that's why people do it. But it's not great for the plant because, obviously, if it's all folded up, it's not going to be that vigorous as far as growing.
Her theory was that it kind of sends all the nutrients back down.
Because he turned them upside down. Okay.
Oh, I feel like I'm winning this. This is great.
Yes, okay. You are. Yeah, well, I don't want to get into your I say anything
Love
bad
you, Mom.
Against your mother. But yes, you don't want to do that. If you can avoid doing that, it's not helping the bulb in any way, shape, or form. It's just making it look a little bit better and making you maybe feel a little bit better.
All right. Well, we have some calls coming in. Let's turn
to those
now. Is
your mother calling?
Yes. Sorry, Mom. Let's go to Lisa in Alberg. Lisa, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. Great to talk to you guys. I have some yellow irises that were planted near my stone house. And I noticed the last couple of weeks that the rhizome, the root part is all exposed on top of the ground. There isn't any dirt over top of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering if they need to be dug up and then put back under the dirt. I'm not sure where the dirt went, and how to fix them. I'd like to spread them out to propagate them a little bit more. But they have been exposed. I don't know if they were exposed all winter long. So I'm really concerned. Should I just put more dirt over top and hope for the best? Or actually lift them off the ground and then put them actual under dirt?
Thanks, Lisa.
Yeah, Lisa. So actually, it's very natural if these are bearded irises, which I'm assuming that they are. You know, the big ones that have little beards, actually, like little tongues on them, because those grow from those rhizomes, and those rhizomes want to be just on the surface of the soil. So, in fact, it's good that you're seeing the tops of those rhizomes, because if you plant them too deep, then they will not flower very well. As far as propagating them goes, especially if you've had that patch there for a while, you might notice that all the new growth is around a ring around the rhizomes. And so in the middle, you just see rhizomes in kind of a blank area, and then all the growth and the flowers are around them. That's a sign that they're overcrowded. And so what you want to do after they're done flowering and after that foliage again starts to yellow, like we were talking with the daffodils, which is probably more like early midsummer, you want to dig the whole thing up. And you want to separate out those individual rhizomes. As long as they have a fan of leaves with them, you can take that, and that's a whole new plant. And you can replant it in the same spot or a different spot with similar conditions. You do want to check the rhizomes for any little holes in them or any that are soft and mushy. soft and mushy is not good for rhizomes.
Doesn't sound good.
No. Yeah. It could be the iris borer that's gotten in there. So if you have rhizomes like that, you want to just compost them, get rid of them. But as long as they're solid, they look good, just cut them and separate them out, having one fan of leaves with each. And you could be sharing them with friends, neighbors, whoever, and just making more beds.
Great. Well, Lisa, good luck with the irises. We have Patricia in Fairhaven calling in. Patricia, you're on the air. Go ahead.
I am. Hello.
Hi.
I'm calling because I have a question about onions.
All right.
So I ordered onions from Texas, and they're coming Thursday, and I'm wondering how I can be most successful planting them and if you have some recommendations.
So you're getting onion plants. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I am.
So, I would put them in the ground as soon as you can. It is onion season, as well as pea season and radish season and greens season, because they need to have a lot of growth time before we get to the solstice, because that's when they'll start setting their bulb. So the more they grow between now and then, the bigger the bulb you'll end up getting. So when you get them, they'll probably be in a big bunch. You might want to just soak them in water a little bit, especially if they look like they've been a little dehydrated from the shipping, and then go out there the next few days. Is going to be perfect for transplanting. Cool, rainy weather. Create a raised bed with nice loose soil. Dig little holes or poke little holes in that soil. If it's really loose soil, you can even just use your finger. And then just pop them in, probably about, I'd say, 6 to 8 inches apart in rows inside in that bed. And that's pretty much all you have to do. And just keep them well watered and keep them weeded. That's the other thing. Onions, garlic, shallots, they don't do well competing with weeds. So if you can keep that bed weeded, they'll produce even better for you.
Great. Thanks, Patricia. Texas onions.
Texas onions,
love
yeah.
That.
Hopefully they're long day onions. So Texas is, of course, much further south, and they grow short day onions. The difference is the short day onions are normally planted in the fall. They overwinter because they have mild winters. And then you harvest them kind of like garlic. You harvest them earlier in the summer. Long day onions, like the ones we have to grow, you plant them in the spring, and then with the longer days, that's when they get big. And then after the solstice, then they start making their onions, and you harvest them a little bit later.
All right. Well, very, very curious about those. Never had them.
Yeah.
Love to try them. We got an email from Lisa in Newport who asks, is it too soon to plant dahlia tubers?
Well, yes. Up in Newport, I would say so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'd wait another week or so. If you want to get a jump start, you can always put them in a pot with some potting soil. You know, pot them all up, get them going, get them growing a little bit. Put them in a protected spot outside where they're not going to get frosted. They are very sensitive to frost. And then you can get a little bit of a jump on the season. But if they're not showing any signs of really wanting to grow wherever you stored them, just leave them there for another week or so.
Charlie, it is May. We're deep in it, which means we are also in the middle of No Mow May.
Right.
I got a question from a listener who writes, I find that No Mow May, which I'm hoping you'll be able to explain, is a difficult thing to accomplish. If I don't mow the lawn around the house in May, my garden tractor will choke and die on the 8 to 10 inch tall grass. I can use the flail mower on the compact tractor, but it is hardly maneuverable in that space. When I do mow, it is always as high as the mower will go, about 4 inches. I don't mow the 5 acres of field until August when, theoretically, any birds are done nesting. So listeners kind of struggling a little bit with how to accomplish No Mow May. First, tell us what it is, and then maybe we can talk about some problem solving.
Yeah, so No Mow May started actually in Europe and over in England. And the idea behind it is that most lawns, most people's lawns, are not pure grass. They've got weeds. We get questions on them all the time.
Yes.
And some of these weeds are actually very good for pollinators. And so the point is, in May, a lot of these, especially the nesting bees, like the honeybees and the bumblebees, they're out there, they're foraging, they're looking for pollen, and May is a really critical time for them. If we let those lawns grow up and don't mow them, then a lot of these weeds will flower, and so theoretically, they will get all the benefit from that. I know that it's been promoted and it's a great idea, and I'm all for pollinators and creating situations, especially in your lawn, for pollinators. But I don't think this is a great idea. I don't really agree with the thinking behind it for a couple different reasons. First of all, for Vermont especially, we have a thing called ticks. And ticks love high grasses. So if you have high grasses and you're trying to walk around your yard and everything, there's a higher chance you might get ticks attacking you and attaching to you. The other thing about it is not all weeds are created equal. Hmm. Some of the weeds that come up are not necessarily the best weeds for pollinators. Things like lesser celandine and even things like dandelion. Now, dandelion, you'll see bees on it all the time. It does have protein, but it's not as good as a lot of the native plants that are out there. So just because you have weeds in your lawn may not be the ones that the pollinators really are going to get the biggest benefit from. And then finally, what happens June 1st?
I don't know.
Everybody gets out there with their mower and they're just mowing it all down again. And think of yourself as a bee. It's like, wait a minute, I was going to Michaela's house for lunch and now it's gone. So this idea of having a big flush of all these flowers that the pollinators can enjoy and then they're gone is probably not a great idea. I would rather see people take a small patch of somewhere in their yard, and it could be small. It could be like a little 5x8 or 4x8 patch or something like that. And you can experiment with no mow. We just let that grow up, but leave it. Don't mow it in June. Mm. Just leave it as a meadow and see what happens. You might get some later flowers coming in. If you're getting flowers like prunella and violets, and even creeping Charlie, those are better pollinator flowers as far as weeds go than some of the other ones out there. If you're not getting a lot of flowers, then the other option, of course, is to mow it down, lay down some newspaper, bring in some hay mulch and some compost and make a bed out of it, and sow wildflowers. So native wildflowers that will have annuals, perennials, and biennials in them. So you'll get some color this year, and the bees will get the color. And then eventually it'll just turn into a perennial bed that's kind of a wildflower bed. And then you would just kind of cut it all down late fall, early winter. Mm. I'd rather see people do that because it would be a consistent supply of food for the bees and the pollinators than just having this big bash, Burning Man via the pollinators in May, and then everything is gone in June and the rest of the summer.
But No-Mow May is so catchy. What are we going to call this? Sometimes, somewhere.
Maybe mow in May. I don't know. I have to come up with a new phrase.
We'll work on it.
Yeah, okay.
Well, let's go back to the phones. We have Carl calling from St. Johnsbury. Carl, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Michaela and Charlie.
Hi.
So I've had a bunch of surgeries lately, and so I can't. It's tough for me to bend over and weed. I'm thinking about going to black plastic, and I know there's pros and cons. Obviously I won't plant my potatoes there, but can you give me some tips about what to avoid and how to make that work?
So are you talking about black plastic on the pathways or around the plants themselves?
No. Yeah, I was just going to lay the plastic down and then poke holes and, mm-hmm. and plant.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of commercial operations do that. A lot of vegetable and even some fruit. So strawberry growers, for example, will do that to avoid the weeds. So if you really don't have the ability to get down and weed and take care of it, and that's no other option, sure, you can do that. It's not the best thing for your soil and not the best thing for the garden, but we have to do what we have to do, considering a situation. A better idea would be, if you could manage it, is to get some raised beds that are pretty high, raised up pretty high, especially if you're just doing a small garden. So if you get something that's built up maybe 3 feet or so, and it could be a metal raised bed, it could be a wooden raised bed. If you get creative, you can use blocks and things to make a bed that way. And that would raise it up so you don't have to bend over. And then you can just fill that up with soil, maybe even put some stuff in the bottom of it if it's a wooden raised bed, where you can put a false bottom in it and just create a bed that's maybe only a foot deep. And that's all the most annual flowers and vegetables need anyway. That way it'll be at a level that it will be easy for you to manage, and you can grow whatever you want, and you can have some healthier soil in there as opposed to using the black plastic.
Mm. Well, thank you, Carl, for calling in, and we hope you start feeling better soon as well. Next, we'll go to Mark in Albany, New York. Mark, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for the call and great show. My question is, I've got a fairly thin lawn and a lot of crabgrass. Is there a way to put crabgrass preventer down but also get new seeds started? Or is it one or the other?
Well, you know, you probably have missed the window, especially if you're in Albany, New York, Mark. The window is when forsythia are starting to bloom. That's when you put that pre-emergent herbicide down. And the organic one that's probably the best and safest to use is corn gluten meal. And it's a byproduct of the corn industry. And it is a pre-emergent, natural pre-emergent herbicide that if you put it on your lawn right when the forsythia are starting to bloom, that will kill a lot of those pre-emerging crabgrass seeds. if it looks like, if you wander around your neighborhood and you still see forsythia blooming, you can give it a try. It may still be worth a try. You might be able to get kind of some of the later ones that are trying to germinate. But that would be the time to naturally put it down, and that usually works pretty well in the crabgrass, because once you knock it out from emerging in the spring, it's not really going to come back much after that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Mark, thank you, and good luck with that. Charlie, I just thought of a question for you out of our last caller who had brought up black plastic. Mm-hmm. The word plastic triggered something that I found so interesting in one of your recent All Things Gardening episodes from a couple, I think it was your Earth Day episode with Mary Angish a couple Sundays back. You said that you can't recycle plastic gardening pots in the normal way, which I didn't know. And mm-hmm. I don't know what I've been doing with mine in the past, but I'm worried that it's not right. what can you do with those gardening pots? Because there's going to be a lot of those floating around this time of year.
Yes, that is a big concern in the whole horticultural industry, because they use a lot of plastic. If you've ever gone to a nursery or garden center, you see all these little pots all over the place. And many of them, if not all of them, cannot be recycled through the normal means. Luckily, there is the Vermont Nursery and Landscape Association has set it up with a group in Connecticut that does recycle these pots. They have a special method or device, whatever it is. And so a lot of the local nurseries in Vermont now will have special days where you can bring in your old pots and you can collect them there. Then they collect them and then they ship them off to this place in Connecticut, and they do get recycled that way. The other thing you could do, of course, is to use those pots. I do this all the time when I'm starting seedlings, those little 4-packs and 6-packs you buy them in. I save those, I clean them up, and then I reuse them 1 or 2 or 3 times until they start falling apart. Mm. So that way, at least you're not buying new ones all the time and really trying and creating more and more plastic garbage that has to be dealt with.
Mm. They always make me think of making popsicles. I know it wouldn't work because there's holes in the bottom, but if you clean them really well, right.
Yeah.
Think about it.
Okay.
All right, let's go back to the phones before I come up with more terrible ideas. Gene in Derby is on the line. Gene, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. And I was wondering, Charlie, have you had much experience with no-till gardening? I have these beautiful raised beds from last year that I don't know, I'm getting older and creaky here.
Sure.
And don't have probably the desire to redo all over again, which is what I should do. I have a tiller. I'm wondering, I planted a cover crop. I weed whacked it last year, so the paths and the beds themselves are covered with weeds and cover mm-hmm. material. What about just poking holes, popping the plants in, top dressing, and maybe another layer of mulch?
Gene, you are in luck because Charlie Narduzzi is an expert in no-dig gardening. What are your tips for her?
I wrote the book.
Yeah, you did.
Well, not the book, but
well,
I did write
my
book on no-dig gardening. Yes, I do have a book on no-dig gardening. I talk about it a lot. So, Gene, yes, it's a great idea. I won't go too far into all the details.
Did you pay
it.
Gene to call in?
Well, Jean's actually my sister. No. but not to go into all the details, but some of the advantages of it is that what's happening is it's going to be less work for you, because what you're doing is mimicking what happens in nature. When leaves drop down in the fall, they create this organic material that slowly breaks down. And then in the spring, seeds drop onto that and they germinate and plants grow and trees grow and nobody's fertilizing them. So this whole idea of no dig is really one that's caught on, not just in gardening, but in agriculture too, the whole no-till methods. So I would suggest what you do, since you have a cover crop of weeds and things you've already kind of put down there, is that I would start doing a couple layers on top of that. Maybe get some hay or some straw, chop it up a little bit, make a layer of that. Maybe get some green material, like collect some of the grass clippings from your lawn and put that over it. If you have some old leaves from the fall, chop those up, but cap the whole thing off with compost. And since you're doing it this time of year and it's not going to be able to break down quick enough to get plants growing really well, you probably want to have a 6 to 8 inch thick layer of compost on top of that bed and then plant literally right into it. Once you've done that and you've got the plants growing, then every year after that, what you'll do is in the fall, you either do what I call chop and drop, which is if you have flowers or vegetables, that are healthy, that looked okay, just get your hedge trimmer and just chop them down into little pieces and just leave them there. Hmm. And that's your mulch for the winter. If you have plants like a tomato that's got a lot of diseases from blights and things, just cut it off at the ground level. Don't pull it out because we're not disturbing that soil. We don't want to disturb it, step on it, till it, turn it, do any of those things. Remove that tomato and then just put down some hay mulch, chopped leaves, something like that. But always keep the ground covered with either plants or organic materials. And then in the spring, this time of year, what you do is come in with another layer of compost, put it right on top, plant right through it. You don't have to turn it, don't have to till it, don't have to do anything. You'll see that the soil will be kind of loose and easy to work, and your plants will grow very well. And you can just sit back and have a glass of lemonade.
All right, Gene, thanks for calling in. Perfect. There we go. No dig gardening. Next up, we have Harry in Cornish, New Hampshire. Harry, how's it going?
Good. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Good. Hi, Charlie. Hey, Michaela. This is great. I've loved listening to you for many years. I have a question for you, and I have a plot of land here in New Hampshire, and I want to make kimchi. So I plan to plant the cabbage, the red pepper, and the radish, kind of the main central ingredients for kimchi. But I've never done this before, so I wonder if you can give me some advice on how to get started, because I want to create like a small batch down the road annually. And then sell.
Yes. So the cabbage and the radish, which is the daikon, I'm assuming, the bigger root, those are ones you can plant now. So first of all, of course, you've got to start with the soil. So you want to either have a raised bed or an area that's already kind of ready set up. If you don't, you can create I would do it all in raised beds. It's just easier. You get better soil and you don't have to dig it. I like that. Huh? So get your raised bed, put some compost or a mix of compost and topsoil into that raised bed, like a 50-50 mix if you haven't started one already. If you already have a raised bed, to pull out the weeds, there are going to be weeds in there, and then put a layer of compost over it. And then I would say at this point, you don't want to try to start cabbage seedlings because it's kind of late. You could do them as a fall crop, but for spring, I would go to a local garden center and get your cabbages, whatever the green cabbages. I don't know if you use red ones for kimchi, but anyway, the right kind of cabbage that for them. Get those transplants and pop them in the ground. Put them right in now. And also leave a space for the daikon, which you will sow like a carrot or a regular radish. And you'll sow those right now. So you have those two going now. And the third one was the pepper. And it's a little early to be starting peppers or putting peppers outside. And I'm not sure if this is a special type of pepper you need for kimchi. But again, it's too late really to start them from seed. So I would be looking around at garden centers for whether it be a sweet or a hot pepper or something in between and get those varieties. And I would wait another down in Cornish, I think it is. Probably somewhere between Mother's Day and Memorial Day. Just kind of watch the weather as long as it's getting kind of warmer. Peppers are very finicky. If it's too cold, they'll drop their flowers. If it's too hot, they won't get pollinated. They want the weather just right. So don't be in a rush to put them out.
Mm. All right, Harry, we're going to plan a pickling show for a couple months from now, and you can call in and let us know how the kimchi went. I also love this idea, Charlie, of planting a garden with like a specific dish in mind.
Yeah, you know, there's pizza gardens that they do a lot with kids, that whole idea of all the toppings on the pizza is in a garden. So there's all different kinds of ways to do this. It could be the kimchi garden. It could be your pickle garden. You mentioned pickling.
Yeah.
All different kinds of cucumbers and beans and things of other nature that you pickle. So yeah, you could just come at it from a culinary aspect as opposed to just, I've got to grow these because everyone grows bush beans. So I must grow bush beans.
All right. Well, Harry, thanks so much for calling in. One more call before we have to take another quick break. But we have David in St. Johnsbury on the line. David, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I've got a wild raspberry patch, a couple of them on my wild farm, and, you know, just native Vermont acreage. And I'm wondering what I can do to encourage them, maybe make them spread out, whatever.
Yeah, so the wild raspberries are nice. They're obviously not as plentiful or as large a fruit as the ones from the cultivated varieties. That's why they created these varieties. But if you just want to have some wild raspberries in your on your farm in your area, one of the things you'll do is make sure they're in full sun, as much sun as possible. So favor the patches that have a lot of sun, or if you need to limb up some trees or remove some weeds or whatever is around there, make sure they have a lot of sun. Then you want to mow some paths. So if you have a big swath of wild raspberries, it's going to be hard to get in the middle of them. So mow some paths so that the actual paths or the actual beds are maybe 4 feet wide or so. That way you can get on either side of them to take care of them. Then get some wood chips. Arborist wood chips are great, and just put a whole bunch of them down on that row and just leave those there. That'll smother some of the weeds. They'll break down into a nice compost eventually that the raspberries really like. And then just do your annual pruning like you would for regular raspberries. So there are ways to kind of bring it up. If you want to really boost them a little more, you can even put a little organic fertilizer or compost down before the wood chips too. But those are ways you can actually bring them along a little bit. You might get a little bit larger fruit from that, but it certainly won't be as nice as the ones that you get from a local raspberry farm, for example.
I love that. That's my favorite fruit.
Yeah.
Good luck with that, David. Also, self-correction, as I was just thinking, listening. Kimchi, fermented, not pickled. So we'll do a fermenting and pickling show.
Fermenting and pickling, yes.
For our caller, Harry.
Yeah, all right. Very good.
Okay. Just setting the record straight here. Let's squeeze in one more call. Peg in Rutland on the line. Peg, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Charlie. This is Peg Andrews, the voice from the way back past.
Oh, wow. How are you, Peg?
I'm doing well, Charlie, and I'm enjoying your show, and I have just one very, very, very tiny comment, which is it sounds like you're asking us to replace No-Mo May with pollinator plots.
Yeah, roughly, but not as sophisticated. I'm not asking you to create a whole big pollinator garden in your yard. I'm just asking for a little area for the pollinators.
Yep, that's what I mean, a little plot.
Little plot. Okay. So, that's your catchphrase.
Got the alliteration.
Oh,
okay. All
pollinator
right.
Pollinator plot. A pollinator. Okay. Okay. You got
just,
it, Peg.
It's just a turn of phrase.
Okay. Well.
So I'll let you guys get on.
Work on the patent for that name.
Thanks for calling in, Peg. Charlie, we got an email from Dan in Williamstown who says our vegetable garden has biblical plague proportions of snake worms. We do sheet composting, so there's a lot of food for them. I know they are detrimental to forests and there's no getting rid of them, but in a vegetable garden, aren't the huge amount of castings they leave behind beneficial?
Ah, good question. So I do talks all over, and no matter what the topic of my talk is, one of the first questions I always get when I'm done is, what about the jumping worms? What about the Asian snake worms? Yes, they are all over the place. I think it's 38 states now around the country where they've found them. They've been around for decades, but I think it's become more evident that the results of their feeding and what they do on forests and in gardens.
What do they look like for someone who's never seen them?
Oh, okay. So you have your, well, first of all, this is kind of an interesting little factoid you can throw out at a next dinner party. There are no native or very few native earthworms in North America. They all kind of got wiped out in the last ice age it came through. So most of the earthworms you see when you dig in the garden came from Europe. So they're actually not native. They're imported. The Asian ones came over a couple decades ago. So the difference between the European and the Asian is that the European earthworms tend to be deeper in the soil. They have a little band around them that's pink colored and it's raised up off of the surface of their skin. Whereas the Asian ones will be on the shallow as I forgot his name.
Dan,
thank you. As Dan was mentioning, there'd be right on the top layers of the soil, they have a white band that goes around that's a milky white color, and it's flush with the rest of their skin. And they snake around. So when they're disturbed, they do the same running or walking that a snake would do, that kind of serpentine movement. And also, they can jump. This one really startled me when I saw it. You know, if you irritate them enough, they jump up at you.
How high?
Oh, I was kneeling down, and they came up, I'd say, about a foot tall.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. They should go to the Olympics or something. So these jumping worms are there, and the thing about them is that they have a big appetite. And so they eat a lot of organic matter, as Dan was mentioning. And what they leave behind is like these coffee ground-like frass or castings, which are not that great for plants, especially for seeds trying to germinate. So they're unlike the European ones where the castings are kind of nice to have. These are not so great. So that's why you see in forests a lot of times that are invaded by jumping worms, not a lot of understory, not not a lot of new plants growing up because the seeds don't germinate very well and the plants don't grow very well in these castings. So if you're wondering if you have jumping worms, there's a way to find out. You take a mixture of 1/3 a cup of ground mustard seed in a gallon of water and pour that, slowly pour that over the bed that you're looking at. And you'll see the jumping worms will come to the surface because they don't like that mustard mix. And then what you can do is pick them. Pick them out, put them in a plastic bucket, put them in a plastic bag, something like that, and then just leave them out in the driveway and let them fry. That's pretty much
that
what you're going to do.
That just sounds vindictive.
We will get to. But you won't get rid of them because they have these microscopic little cocoons and eggs that are brown in the soil. So you're never going to see them. So that's why... a lot of people recommend now that when you're doing plant swaps, we talked about plant swaps before the show started, that you wash off all the soil of your plants before you swap them with someone because you might be inadvertently spreading the jumping worm or the snake worm to someone else. One thing you can do, though, when you get, because the snake worms will come in on compost that hasn't been decomposed really well, or even on wood chips and bark mulch, is you could lay that material out on a tarp and then put some clear plastic over it and solarize it for 3 days as long as it gets over 105 degrees. That will kill the jumping worms and kill the cocoons and eggs too. So that's something you could do. And even if you have a raised bed where you're planting vegetables and annual flowers, this time of year, you can cover it over with that plastic, and that should help kill a lot of them that are in there.
All right. Well, Dan, good luck with those jumping worms. Sorry we didn't have better news for you about the castings.
It is what
it
is.
I don't know about those. All right. Let's go to Abby in Randolph next. Abby, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. I have a question for Charlie and maybe others. Deer were very happy this winter. They ate pretty much gnawed down my yews, which they love, and some cedars. And I just don't know whether I should be patient and see if they come back or if it's really a lost cause.
Well, the cedars probably are not going to come back really well. They will come back somewhat, but I've often seen them, and you probably have too. You look at a field or you look at a yard, and everything is kind of chewed up all the way up to about four or five feet tall, which is how high the deer can munch, and then above it, it's okay. So the yews might come back again very slowly. So if they look like they're really devastated, they're really struggling to come back this spring, I would consider replacing them with things that are not as deer-friendly, like some of the columnar junipers, for example, or the red cedars that are a native tree in the Champlain Valley. Those are trees that will grow up and the deer don't seem to bother them. As far as the yews go, there are some other kinds of junipers that are more bush-like that might be a better alternative.
Mm. All right. Well, thanks so much for calling in, Abby. We're going to get through a couple of these callers, try to answer as many questions as we can in the time we have left. Kathy is in the Upper Valley. Kathy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Charlie. I have a new chicken brood, and we want to have raised beds. What do we need to do?
What do you need to do for making the raised beds?
To make sure that the chickens don't eat everything that we planted.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yeah, keep the chickens out of the raised beds. Uh-huh. Probably cover the raised beds. And you can get some kind of chicken wire to go around them. They call it chicken wire for a reason. And maybe some kind of a mesh to go over the top of them. So, you know, of course, some chickens can fly pretty high, actually. So I would suggest doing that. Really just kind of accepting the fact that you're going to have a covered bed or a covered raised beds if you want to have the chickens free ranging around them.
Mm. All right. Thanks so much, Kathy. Enjoy those new chickens. Luke in Morrisville is on the line. Luke, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, you mentioned not mowing in May, but how do you feel about biweekly mowing and how that would help the environment and the pollinators?
Well, you know, that would help for sure. And another thing you can do is mow high, which is a great catchphrase. Mow high, if you mow 3 or above inches tall, what you can do is mow above a lot of the low-growing pollinator flowers like white clover and prunella and thyme, things of that nature that might be in your lawn, and that would preserve them, and still you'll have something that looks more or less like a lawn. It's just going to be a little thicker than you normally would see.
All right.
Yeah.
The theme always emerges in these conversations. Uh-huh. I think the one today is the new catchphrase we're trying to build for No Mow May.
Right. Pollinator plot.
Yep.
Mohai.
still brainstorming. All right. Let's go next to Janice, who's up in Newport. Janice, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, my husband likes to mow high and I don't like it. But anyways,
I won't get in between.
You're not alone.
We have maybe a just northeastern a side. Yeah, there you go. We have a northeastern side to our house, and I would like to plant flowers in there, maybe perennials that look good and like that kind of shade. We have two peonies out there now. But I don't think there's anything else out there. What would you suggest planting would be good in the shade?
Do the peonies flower out there?
They do.
Oh, they do. Yeah. Okay, so you're probably getting more sun than you think if the peonies are flowering. That opens up the door to a lot of things that would do well with morning light, you know, 4 to 6 hours of sun. It could be everything from low-growing things like the hellebores and the bruneras. I'm just going to name drop. Forget-me-nots do well in that. Lamium is a nice another ground cover. Some of the larger plants for shade, especially if it's a wet shade, Ligularia. The yellow rocket is a nice tall one that does well there. Jobhyweed will do okay in those kind of situations. If there's sections that are heavier shade, you might want to go more towards the hosta fern kind of thing. So there's a lot of different possibilities that are out there. I would just say do a little research. Look for plants that can survive with 3 to 4 hours of direct sun, morning sun, and just try them out and see which ones really take in your landscape.
Mm. All right. Well, good luck, Janice. Thanks for that call. Let's take one more caller, and then I have a question for you, Charlie.
Oh, you?
Yep, okay. Me. Jeb in Essex Junction first, though. Jeb, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I'm driving, so I hope the reception is good. Hands-free. We just have started a new no-dig garden, Charlie. I gave my wife your book. She read it. I didn't. But we put maybe 5 to 7 sheets of newspaper down, then the leaves, then the soil. And the question is how long, and it's going to be perennials mainly, mm-hmm. how long before you can dig through the newspaper to put a bigger transplant in?
Yeah, so since you just did it now, it's going to take a little while to break down the leaves and the newspaper. And I would suggest if you want to put a thicker layer of soil, of compost on top, I've mentioned 6 to 8 inches before, that would at least give you the option of planting a little earlier. Otherwise, you might have to wait a month or so before you actually can plant some things into it. So that's the option. And I'm glad your wife bought the book and she read it and that's great.
You're next, Jeb. Got to read that book. Thanks for the call, Jeb. Good luck with the no-dig gardening. All right. I want to end with ants.
With you, Michaela.
With me. Yes. I have an ant question that we've gotten a couple other ant questions from folks, too. Mine is, why do ants love peonies so much?
Ah, because they open up the flowers, of course. Ants have amazing strength that people don't realize, and they peel back the flower petals so that the petals of the flower opens up, and that's why it opens.
No way.
Yeah, it's exactly. That's wrong.
Oh, I really
that's a fable. That's a myth.
I really believe
that's folklore. I know. You were really just sucked into that, weren't you? No. So the answer on the peonies, because the peonies have this, they exude a sugary nectar substance, and so they're feeding on it, basically. And that's why when they start forming, the peony bud starts opening up. They get more of that nectar that's available for them, so they go up there. So they're not really opening the flowers. It might look like that.
I can't believe you lied to me.
I didn't lie. I just told you a story. That's all. A tall tale.
We'll talk about it after the show, Charlie. Okay, we got a couple questions about ants. One from Charlie in Montpelier, who says, one section of our garden is infested with ants, creating large, unsightly mounds. It's been going on for years. Last year, the ants moved over to our front walk where they buried under the pavers and spread granite sand all over the place. How do we get rid of the ants, which are undermining our attempts to have attractive plants and walk in front of our house? We also got a question from my colleague, Jen, who writes, ants, all capital letters. How can one safely and humanely get rid of them in beds?
In beds. Oh, beds, not beds. Garden beds. Okay.
Yes. Hopefully. I don't know what the situation is indoors over there, but yes.
Okay.
Garden beds.
Yes. So for ants, they like a really well-drained soil, like a sandy soil. That's why they will create these mounds and these whole villages of ants. One of the things you could do is you could try to use some natural things like lemon peels and orange peels, something citrusy. Spread that around. Cinnamon people have used and to try to ward them off, to get rid of them. And some people have tried to just flood them with water, but that doesn't really work. You know, they'll kind of come back. So you could also set up little traps with boric acid in them, but you want to put the boric acid traps in like a glass jar that has a few holes poked in the top of it. And that way and put a little sugar in there too. And that way they'll come back, they'll take the boric acid and the sugar back to the nest, and the boric acid, of course, will kill the ants. So there's a few things you can try to do that way. I've had success with tansy, believe it or not. I asked about the indoors because we had ants in the house once. And we took just branches of tansy, which is an herb, and just laid that around on counters and things, and that drove the ants away.
Really?
They did not like the tansy. So that might be something you try in your garden, is to grow tansy and see if that helps.
Okay, cool. Well, thanks. Those are great tips. Yeah. Charlie, how can the people get more Charlie Nardozzi? What events do you have coming up? Do you have any garden tours?
Yes. Well, I definitely have some garden tours going on. I'll be going to Denmark and Sweden this fall in September. That trip is sold out, but we always have a waiting list and people always drop out for various reasons. So that's something to put on your calendar, or if you're interested, contact me at my website, gardeningwithcharlie.com. And next spring, we're going to Sardinia, Italy in May. Around this time of year, actually. And that trip is not official yet, but if you're interested in it, again, just send me an email. We'll get you on a list and we'll let you know all about it.
All right. I'm going to try to get Vermont Public to cover that extensively.
We could do a live show.
Send over a local host. I think it's very important.
In Italian from Sardinia.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that. Charlie Nardozzi, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. I've learned so much.
It's a lot of fun, Michaela.